First up is Daniel Cavisi. Daniel is a movie studio story analyst, teacher, writer, and private screenplay consultant with more than 15 years of experience working professionally on the craft and business of screenplays. He's worked with Miramax Films, Dimension Films, 20th Century Fox, New Line Cinema, Clínica Estético Films. He's evaluated written submissions for executives who developed and or executive produced the film Chicago, Limitless, Spy Kids, Scream 2 and 3, Chocolat, The Wedding Singer, One Fine Day, The Game, Yuli's Gold, and many others. Let's bring him on. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Barbara. How's it going?
Great. Great to have you. Let's begin by talking about Story Maps, TV drama, the structure of the one-hour television pilot, and how the book came about.
Well, I had always focused on features in my own writing and my own coaching with writers and students for years. And at a certain point, my students kept asking me, Dan, do you have a story map for television? You know, I'm known for creating these roadmaps that help writers create a script from the ground up. So things like an act beat sheet, for example, a template for a writer's screenplay structure. And I was watching so much TV, and I kept having my students ask me, well, do you have a story map like you do for features for television, you know, one-hour television drama? And so I started to read a ton of pilots and watch a ton of shows and pilots and really analyze them and see if they did have commonalities of structure. And I did find out that there was, in fact, a lot of commonalities, a lot of similar beats. As you may or may not know, most one-hour TV dramas are broken into what is called a teaser plus four-act structure or a teaser plus five-act structure. And they do actually contain a lot of similar beats and templates. And so I really wanted to put that down in the first book, really, to break it down in that much detail. And so my writers are finding a lot of use for it.
Yeah, I find Story Maps to be such a useful book. I really like how you walk writers through the process of writing TV drama. And I love the beat sheets for shows like Breaking Bad, Mad Men, Walking Dead, Game of Thrones, etc. And I'm curious why you chose these particular shows to break down.
Well, it was partly that just shows that I like. It was partly ones that are popular and I felt like represented different genres of TV and really a number of groundbreaking shows over the last decade. You know, Breaking Bad and Mad Men may be over in their runs, but they're still going to stand time as classic shows and you can still learn from studying them. It was really just saying, what are the most groundbreaking shows of the last 10 years? So something like The Sopranos, I wanted to leave out because it's a bit too old at this point, I think, to be totally relevant to this particular era of TV. You can still learn a lot from The Sopranos pilot, but I just wanted to focus on kind of more recent shows.
Well, I'm happy. I'm happy
Great.
You know, one thing that may be surprising to writers in genres other than screenwriting is how much planning needs to happen before the actual writing of a TV pilot or TV show, maybe even a screenplay, I suppose. Can you talk a bit about that and just why all that planning is necessary?
Well, there's a defined act structure in the industry, you know, in the television industry. As I said, you usually have this defined act structure. And the difference with TV pilots is that those acts are actually labeled. So there's nowhere to hide, you know. Your teaser should be, it's labeled teaser, you know, centered at the top of the page, underlined. So we know that this is the cold open or, you know, inciting incident of the pilot, and it should last around 2 to 8 pages. Now, if your teaser lasts 42 pages out of a 55 page script length, then that industry reader is going to know immediately that you don't understand the basic industry standard structure. So it's just the way it is. Act structure in television came about because of commercial breaks originally. So you want to have these segments in between commercial breaks, and you want to basically have like a cliffhanger at the end of each act that made people stay tuned through the commercial, you know? So that structure evolved, and it's usually either a teaser plus four act or a teaser plus five act. But they're labeled, so you really got to know what you're doing, you know, unlike a novel where it's broken down by chapter, but it's really up to you, like, how long each chapter should be or really whatever you want to do.
And does this rule hold for web-based series that I see are happening more and more?
Well, it's interesting because web series really, I mean, they can be any length. It's really up to you. You might see 2-minute episodes, you might see 8-minute episodes. But what's happening is professionally, a lot of creators are using web series as a launch pad to then sell a series to a more traditional network or platform, you know, like a Hulu or Netflix. And once they do that, the network or platform is asking them for a more traditionally structured show. Mm-hmm. So if it's a sitcom, they want a 22 to 28 minute episode structure, whereas, you know, your web series may have been 8 to 10 minutes. Well, they want you to come in with a pilot that's written in either that 22 to 30 minute sitcom length, or if it's going to be a 1-hour drama, they want it to be in that 50 to 60 page length. So you kind of have to know that structure to take that leap from the web to a network or Hulu or Netflix or whatever.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. I wasn't really sure whether that was the case, that creators of web series want to stay there, or that's a launching plan or pad. So that's kind of interesting.
And it's interesting because that has evolved over the last 10 years. No one really knew like where YouTube was going to go, and they weren't really mining talent from YouTube. But kind of slowly over the past decade, these other, you know, multi-channel networks on YouTube, many of which have corporate parents or networks, are grabbing talent from there. But they're saying, you know what, we have this defined structure. And even on YouTube, it's funny because they're saying, even though most kids watching YouTube, for example, are watching like 5-minute vloggers, they're still saying they're used to that network TV structure, so we're going to develop it into more of a traditional length and structured show. So it's kind of interesting that it's become that. You know, it went from this really free-form, short-form, open platform to more traditional type of storytelling.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'm here with Daniel Covisi. His book that we're talking about is Story Maps, TV Drama, The Structure of 1-Hour Television Pilot. There's so much great writing on TV these days. And it's odd for me to even say that because I used to not even have a TV. And it's just like there was nothing I ever wanted to watch. And now there's just such a range of shows with great writing. What do you attribute that mm-hmm. to?
Well, yeah, it's kind of become the new American novel, these ongoing series. And there's a number of factors. I think it is, TV series became more cinematic as home theater systems became more advanced. You know, HDTV came in, and a lot of cable networks that had previously been known for things like, you know, AMC would just air classic movies. Nat Geo would air, animal specials and kind of, you know, specials about nature and the planet. And over the past few years, they've all started developing scripted television because I think they just saw the need there and saw that there was so much good stuff out there. So I think it evolved because there was a voracious appetite for it. Had the element that, unfortunately, people stopped going to the theater to see a lot of those mid-range budget dramas and indie films that had really been a staple of theaters. You know, they started mostly going to the big franchise films, you know, for better or worse. That's what the studios are making, and multiplexes are playing those films. So those filmmakers and storytellers move to television, you know. So you get more of the intelligent, dramatic, mature, long-form cinematic storytelling now on television.
Yeah, I do love the long form. And I'm curious, for writers who want to write for TV, is it better to come up with a serialized show or episodes that stand alone? Is one preferred over the other?
You know, it's not really preferred. It's really up to that one great pilot that you write. That all you need is that one great pilot to break you in. I've heard both, you know. I think it depends on the network. If you have whatever network or production company you're submitting to, what is their specialty, you know? So you're not going to submit your gritty one-hour cop procedural to Freeform, which used to be ABC Family, you know. Your audience for that is not tweens, it's adults. Excuse me. So you really need to know your target. You want to know your audience really before you begin writing, unless you're just one of those writers who just wants to go and kind of let it flow out of you. But you're going to have to come back later to really shape it into that structure. And think about your platform and your audience, you know, your target platform and audience. But it's such a, there's so many different markets and platforms and genres that it really does you well to think about that ahead of time.
So, you know, it used to be, at least I think it used to be, that if you were wanting to break in, and write a pilot or write a series, that the usual way was to write a spec script. But it seems that spec scripts for existing shows is no longer the way. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, I've heard from many industry professionals that just no one's really writing specs anymore. To clarify, TV spec is when you write a script of an existing show. So, like, you write an episode of NCIS. To show that you can write, you know, FBI procedurals. And that used to be a prerequisite. It's not as much anymore. They want you to show your original voice in a pilot. Now, let's say you get a manager and an agent, and they're sending you around on staffing meetings hoping to get you a staff job on an existing show. At that point, they may ask you to write or if you've already written a spec just to try it out, you know, maybe you wanted to write a Game of Thrones spec or a Walking Dead spec just to see what it's like to write in that structure, and you're a fan of that show, you feel like you know that show, go ahead and do that, and that may be a good sample to show to that manager or producer that you are serious, that you have a portfolio. But it's really not a prerequisite these days. It's really all about writing that great pilot. Original, you know, an original pilot that's your vision.
Right. So if you're doing that, how much does a writer need to know about his or her show? In other words, while you're only writing the pilot and submitting the pilot, do you need to know the arc of the season and perhaps even the overall arc of the series? Or is it enough to know pretty much what happens in the pilot?
I think you should know generally where you want to take the series, and I would say know the arcs of the main characters for the first season, and then generally have an idea for the second season. It's basically good when, let's say, you go in to pitch your series, like they read the pilot, they really liked it, they like your voice on the page, and they want to hear more about your vision for this series, you know, the actual television series. it's good to be able to answer questions like they say, okay, what happens at the end of season one? What happens at the end of season two? It's good to know that, but you don't have to have every episode blocked out. You know, you don't have to have a 1-3 paragraph description of every episode. I get that question a lot. They're like, do I need to break down every single episode of the first 5 seasons, for example? You don't. And actually, if you put together like a treatment or a pitch document, or some people call it a mini Bible, mm-hmm. to introduce your show, which has like a character list and the summary and the pitch of the show and talks about the world and the tone, they don't want you to do episode descriptions for the entire first season. They want you to do like 3 to 4, 5 to 6 episodes just to show that you have an idea of potential episodes and where this show might go. You know, what is the week to week of this show going forward? But they don't want you to define every single episode of the first season, because that tells them that you might be rigid and you might not want to work with them to develop it, you know, because every show needs to be developed.
You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Daniel Cavisi. His book is Story Maps, TV Drama, The Structure of the One-Hour Television Pilot. So then in terms of pitching, in terms of getting your show, your pilot, before executives or producers, do you need to be in LA? I mean, if you're pursuing this form of writing, should you really be out here in California so you can meet with producers, meet with TV executives, or can you do it from anywhere?
You probably should be in LA. If your goal is to staff on a show, you do need to be in LA, unless you're in a market that might have a lot of TV shows, like, you know, I don't know for sure, but let's say Toronto, let's say you're in the Canadian TV industry or the Australian TV industry, it may help to be there. But if you're going to staff on a TV show, you know, 90% of them coming out of Hollywood are, the writers' rooms are here, so you do need to be here. Now, to sell a pilot, you don't need to be. So, you know, the dream, of course, is you're wherever you are, whether it's New York or Kansas or Florida or the UK, and you sell a pilot to a network here, and you're the star of the moment. They fly you out, and then maybe you plan to live here for the next 6 months as you develop the series and get it on its feet. But you generally do. But you can be anywhere to write it, you know, to write it and submit it. And a lot of the launching pad these days for scripts, as you probably know, is contests. So to a contest that has a really good track record of getting those scripts to the industry. You can be anywhere, obviously. And if you get noticed in the industry, then you can fly out and take some meetings. And you know what? It's really a good problem to have, to think, oh, they want me to come out to LA and work with them, you know, and they're going to pay me to do that. So I would say don't worry about that. Do not let it, of course, paralyze you. And, you know, don't write the pilot because you live somewhere else and you have a family and stuff. Like, worry about that later. You know, if you're passionate about writing a TV series, then go ahead and write it.
So as a story analyst, and you've read hundreds, perhaps thousands of scripts, is there one mistake or are there several mistakes common to the pilots that you see that don't make it through to even, you know, executives wanting a meeting or what do you see out there?
Probably the biggest note that I hear from people and that I can tell from reading pilots is that it just doesn't seem like there's a engine that's going to sustain that series. The pilot seems too closed-ended of a story, much like a feature. You know, everything's wrapped up by the end, not leaving enough of what I call a compelling crisis or a week-to-week engine to continue that series, you know. It's a really tough thing to do, to tell a cohesive, complete pilot story and yet leave open clear arcs and characters who still have dramatic struggles, you know, and lines of action that are open that we can clearly see will continue into a series, you know. It comes with time. That's why you need to practice and write a lot and study and look at pilots and how they're done and read books. It'll come with time, but it's a really tough thing. So that's really the main thing is this pilot may have a good voice and really have some energy, but can it sustain a series? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Taking the long view and doing the hard work, right? Which I guess in all writing is the hardest part of it.
Mm-hmm. Something like The Walking Dead, the pilot. Obviously, you're like, okay, this is a dystopian world with zombies. There's a lot of zombies around. Then, you know, our main character is going to be fighting zombies. Could be for the next 200 episodes. So we know that there's going to be more fights out there. We know that Rick, his family, is living in a survivor colony outside town. He hasn't reunited with them yet, but we know that he will. So there's that possible thread. His ex-partner on the police force is dating his wife, and they think that Rick's dead. Rick has met up with other survivors, and then in the end, he's inside a tank that's surrounded by hundreds of walkers. So, you know, it's a big cliffhanger. It's how the hell is he going to get out of this one? And then the last thing is the radio goes off, and there's another human voice on the end of the radio saying, "Hey, you dumbass in the tank." And so we know that there's other people out there in the immediate vicinity who are also battling the walkers. So we know that this story is going to go somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I love that show. So anyway, we are at the end of our time, and I wonder if you say a few words about how people can find you. And I believe you teach online, and maybe say a few words about that.
Yeah, well, you can find my Story Maps books on Amazon. And then my particular website is called act4screenplays.com. That's ACTFOUR, screenplays.com. And I have special offers on like PDF versions of my books. I have discount bundles of PDFs. And then I also have Microsoft Word versions of worksheets that I can send you that are exclusive to my clients and the purchasers of my books on my website. And then I wanted to mention, I do work one-on-one coaching clients. I can read your existing screenplay, or I can work with you in a coaching one-on-one environment to develop something from the ground up. I have a defined structure and special class called the Story Map TV Pilot Masterclass, in which I not only give you notes, direct email access on a daily basis, but I bring in two industry professionals to work with my writers and give them feedback. So I'll bring in like a manager, current working manager, and current working executive, or, you know, development assistant, or a number of different professionals. And they give you feedback, and they say, "Hey, I like this log line better than that log line, and I think this one has more commercial potential than the other one." So you really get a lot of feedback on your ideas and your scripts. So I think that's very unique, and you can check that out at my website, act4screenplays.com.
Thank you so much, Daniel, for taking the time. It's been great talking with you.
Thank you, Barbara, and I wish you luck with your pilot. That sounds like you're writing your own pilot.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Sure. All right. Take care.
That was Daniel Cavisi. His book is Story Maps, TV Drama, The Structure of the One-Hour Television Pilot. I have found this book extremely useful, and check it out. It's available many places, and we're going to take a break, and when we come back, hopefully we'll have George Hodgman here, author of Bettyville. Don't go away. Mm-hmm. Oh.
such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Oh, honey, just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby, I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through, deep in my heart I know I've lied. I've lied. I've lied. Such a long, long time. Looks like I'd get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you,
just the thought,
my love, my whole world turns misty blue.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, July 13th, 2016. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. The first half, we were with Daniel Cavisi, author of Story Maps, writing TV drama. Now we're on with George Hodgman. George is a veteran magazine and book editor who has worked at Simon & Schuster, Vanity Fair, and Talk Magazine. His writing has appeared in Entertainment Weekly, Interview, W, Harper's Bazaar, and other publications. He lives in New York City and Paris, Missouri, and he's here today to talk about Bettyville, his memoir, published by Penguin. Hey, George.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Loved the book, of course. And before we go on, I'd love to hear a bit from you in terms of how the book took form, how it came about.
Well, the book is about it's kind of a fish out of water story. It's about how me, this guy who has lived in New York pretty much all his adult life, comes back to this tiny town in Missouri where he's from to take care of his mother, who has dementia. And the book, you know, started in a lot of different ways. I think it really grew out of my fear, because there's a lot written about taking care of an aging parent, but everybody who writes them seem to be super competent people, people who are, women who know how to do everything, and people who are good with insurance forms. And, I mean, this is a book. I was scared. I didn't know whether I could do this. And it called on all the things that I was particularly bad at, from cooking to dealing with bureaucracies, and also dealing with a woman who was, on the one hand, wonderful and who I loved very much, but who was frustrated and angry about her situation. So I wanted to write a book for people who were scared of what was going to happen with their parents. And I also I think that I wanted the tone to be quirkier than most. One day this lady came over who hadn't seen my mother and I together for like 20 years, and she said, "You all are so funny together." And so I thought that was, in a way, where the book crystallized in my mind, because I thought we could be kind of a quirky comedy team, and it wouldn't have to be all sad.
Well, I was thinking as I was reading, or perhaps as I read anything these days, of something that the late writer and notable writing instructor John Gardner said, which was that all books are either about a stranger coming to town or a person going on a journey. And this is sort of both, in a way, because this isn't your town. And even though you were born there, but you've been away and you're journeying back. And so I was curious how much you knew going in terms of, at what point did you know you had to write a book?
Well, I was doing these Facebook posts out of a kind of, loneliness, really, because I was here and I didn't have a whole lot of people to talk to. And a community was kind of developing around my mother and me. And this, I was talking about some of the things that I was confronting, and I realized that an awful lot of people were going through the same thing. And I also... I spent my life as a journalist and editor. I mean, I've written a lot about powerful people, or I've worked on books about powerful people and about celebrities, et cetera. And, I was very, very interested in everyday struggles. And my mother was very courageous. And so I think there was a desire to show the struggle of an ordinary woman at the end of her life and dealing with this, terrible challenge. And with dementia and Alzheimer's, one of the things is that, these people, they know what's going on, and there's this terrible anxiety. Maybe later stage they have let go, but with my mother, it was a sense of her, knowing that she was losing control. And so I don't know. I just thought she was a gutsy old broad, and I wanted to get it on paper. And I think it's very perceptive, because what you say about a stranger coming to town and the journey, because I realized that the book, the book was a journey. It was about, the journey of someone who didn't think he could, who was this self-centered, career-driven, ambitious New Yorker who had always lived for himself, who came home and was kind of inspired by the, kind of old-fashioned spirit of the town that shaped his mother, to learn how to care for somebody else and think about somebody else besides himself.
Hmm. Yeah, there so many great moments in this book. So many laugh out loud moments, and you know, I tend to not mark up books, and I started marking this one up because like I have to remember that scene. I have to go back to that scene. And also, you do something that memoirists are encouraged to do and find it hard to do, which is to sort of be the most difficult character in the book. I mean, to reveal, you know, the flaws and the difficulties. And you do, you know, I would assume that's you. It felt like it was, you know, that's you. It wasn't contrived for the sake of memoir, that is just you. But I wonder if that was difficult for you. I don't know if you're a private person or how much you tell in general, you know, with people you know or run into. But talk about being able to put yourself on the page and keeping the worry away from that process.
Well, as an editor and as a reader, I had dealt with memoir for a very long time. And when I started reading memoir, this little, you know, high school kid in a tiny town, a very homogenous little town, you know, I was actively reading memoirs because I wanted to find out what other kinds of lives were like. And so I wanted, in a way, to explain my life as a gay man to people who I had grown up with who just didn't get this. You know, I mean, right now, today, the Republican Party has passed an incredibly homophobic platform. Mm-hmm. And I wanted these people to sort of get my life as a gay man and what gay kids, you know, in this place were going through, and in a kind of in hostile territory or somewhat hostile territory. And because people in the grocery store were confronting me and, you know, women saying, oh, my God, my friends say that I'm a terrible mother because my daughter's a lesbian. So there was something that was kind of a challenge to me. You know, it was like there was a reason to reveal. There was a reason to be, you know, I felt like there was something to be done other than just tell my story for self-display. There mm-hmm. was a reason. Hmm. And the other thing that I knew from, you know, reading and the work of, you know, editing memoirs is that memoir does not work unless the reader develops a relationship, an intimate relationship with the writer, with the eye of the story. And so I think you have to tell your secrets in a way. You have to tell the reader that you are willing to trust them, and that you are willing to be somewhat intimate with them if you want to forge a kind of, you know, to make the relationship that memoir requires. So was it comfortable? Not exactly. I mean, I kept telling myself that I could always take it out. You know, I can always take this out. I'll just put it in now for a little while. And I actually, a lot of the parts about my life, originally the book was, my life was happening in these sort of flashbacks, and they were italicized and in second person. You know, you. And I think that distance helped me get the stuff I didn't want to talk about on paper. Mm-hmm. And then I read this review of a book. So Janet Maslin review of a book, and she just slaughtered it because it used italics much. So I thought, oh my God. And I had to go back. You know, I took it out of italics, and then if I took it out of italics, I had to change it to second person. Suddenly it was all first person, and here we were. But when, and I, you know, it's like I got really good feedback from people who read it. So then I was scared to take too much out. But at the point when it really went to press and I couldn't change anything, I had a little bit of a big anxiety attack. I mean, there's nothing like thinking about your sixth grade teacher reading about your sex life to keep you up night.
Well, I'm glad you didn't take it out.
Well, I mean, I guess it was because my sex life wasn't really that exciting.
Oh, you are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with George Hodgman. His memoir is Bettyville. You know, as you've been talking about different themes, different things going on in the book, there is so very much going on, and I particularly like memoirs like this, where it's not on one track, that there is a back and forth, and we, you know, we switch location, we switch time, we time is sort of, you know, is malleable, and at the same time, how do you keep track of it all? Are you very organized? Do you have a outline or a storyboard, or, you know, how did you keep track and have it work so well?
Well, to me, there were two narratives, and there was the narrative of, there was what I called, you know, the present tense narrative of me and my mom and what we were going through in our, you know, primarily about her struggle with her illness and my attempt to deal with caring for her. But there was a second narrative of the past, which was really about our relationship. It was, you know, it was kind of, how did we get to the place where we were when the present tense narrative occurs, which was, you know, loving, but also not very communicative and not very open about our lives with each other. And so the second narrative, which is my growing up and what was happening to me in the past, I don't know, I just kind of told those sections chronologically, and it really was built around what I remember. But it was, you know, it was very much an attempt to kind of give you background on this relationship. And what I realized was that, you know, when I wrote about my life, what was clear was that, in a way, all the stuff in my life involved my relationship with my mother and my father. And so it was, I didn't somehow go too far afield.
Mm-hmm.
Past tense stuff didn't work if my mother wasn't in the room, either literally or in my head at the time. I mean, I write about going to the AIDS crisis, but what it really is about is my fear of dying and what that would do to my parents. And so, you know, there was a real connection between the two narratives. And I didn't want to just write another book about taking care of an old person. I wanted it to be also about this, you know, a relationship, a parent-child relationship, and about communication. Because I think what we were facing was, suddenly we was at the end of her life, at a later stage in mine, here we were together in the same house for the first time in 30 years, dealing with each other, and, you know, there were all these things that were kind of still unspoken. And I wanted to write about, you know, how we got to this point with still so many silences around us.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Well, you know, I don't know if throughout your life you kept notes or journals about your life, but I know that one worry of new memoirists is that if they can't remember the exact dialogue of what was spoken, they feel that to recreate it or to fudge it or to reconstruct would be misleading. How did you deal with that, and what do you suggest?
Well, you know what? Mostly what I remember, I mean, I always remember the dialogue. Maybe it's just because maybe I have that kind of, you'll notice it, it's not a point where a book where I say, you know, someone was wearing this or this is what the room looked like. It's where I remember the jokes. I remember the times when we made each other laugh or, you know, and I won't swear. I say in the book, everybody said these things, though I may be wrong about exactly when they said them. And, you know, if you write a memoir, you think, oh, my gosh, I have to remember every second of every, you know, day, month, and year of my life. But I chose the scenes. These are the scenes that I remember. You know, there are 8 or 10 scenes in the book, in the distant past. I don't remember my whole life, but I do remember those scenes. And I think that, I don't know that I would want a special investigation into the absolute veracity or, you know, whether I got it absolutely right all the time.
Yeah.
But I did my best, and I think that all you can do with memory is to do your best.
Yes, yes.
And also not to, you know, there's nothing that's consciously invented. And in the present tense, I mean, that was easy because I was taking, my mother was on the couch. I was writing this book on a card table, you know, a few feet away from her. And I was literally just taking stuff down.
Mm-hmm.
And I think subconsciously she knew what was going on or somehow. Then she developed this habit of always saying her best stuff when I was away from the computer. But I would write it, if we were at the doctor's or wherever it was, I would grab my iPhone and use my email, write it down and email myself lines that she said.
Mm-hmm.
Truth is always better.
Yeah.
You know, it's like truth is always more complex and interesting. So I had also learned that as an editor. If you stick with truth, it's just, you know, truth is also what helps you make the connection with the reader. Once you start fabricating, I think the reader will smell it.
You know, Bettyville is a great title, too, and I'm just obsessed with titles, and I'm wondering if it was always the title and, you know, just your experience of titles and when this title came.
The title came because I have this crazy friend in New York who would always call up and say, what's new in Bettyville? and I realized that, I mean, my life in this period was Bettyville. I was living in an existence that was all about Betty. And that was good, you know, it was fine. But the other meaning of Bettyville to me is that Bettyville signifies this place and her generation. Bettyville is the old Paris, Missouri, where, you know, people behaved in a certain more old-fashioned way and where the community was more tightly knit. So it has kind of a double meaning to me,
mm-hmm.
But I think titles, you know, titles are one of the things where it's like, you just have to kind of relax and let them present themselves because as an editor, you know, I've been in that situation. Like, we've got to find a title. We've got to get it in the catalog. Da, 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 da. There's this, you know, kind of deadline situation. And, you know, I've spent Saturdays just sitting in a chair trying to think about titles, and it almost never works. You have to almost, it takes as much relaxation as exertion to let the title be found.
Mm. So, yeah, the title did a few things, and it also expresses the humor in the book. And I think that's wonderful when a title does more than one thing.
I hope. That would be not, I don't know that it, you know. All I know is she said it, I heard it. I was lucky. I mean, usually you hear titles somewhere else. You hear them, you know. Maybe you're lucky enough to have them present themselves, you know, in your mind or whatever. But I think part of titles is listening for them in the world around you. And luckily, I was listening really hard because I was writing about real life.
Mm. We are at the end of our time. I wonder if, in closing, you can say a few words about the Bettyville TV project.
I don't know. It's Shirley MacLaine is supposed to play my mother, and Matthew Broderick is supposed to play me, and I don't know. It seems some very talented people are doing their best to make it happen, but I think television movies are two things that you don't count on until you turn on the television or buy your ticket. I mean, it seems like it's a pretty crazy kind of process, and you know, I imagine that by the time I tune into it, I will probably be in assisted living myself.
I don't think so. This book has things happening on so many levels and is so visual, and there's so much great dialogue. I mean, all the stuff that good TV has, I think this book has it.
Well, call up HBO right now.
I will.
I mean, it's not the thing that I think that they're facing a lot is that it's kind of a gritty murder world that we're dealing with, and this is a, you know, this is a wry comic character driven piece, and so it may not be the easiest sale in the world.
Well, I wish
maybe if I'd killed my mother it would be probably picked up immediately, or
maybe, but it's good that you didn't. And
I know.
And you wrote just such an excellent memoir that I'm just so pleased to have read it, and thank you for writing it.
Well, I'm pleased not to have been writing it in prison. And so thank you so much for your kind words, and I really appreciate your perspective on it and your interest.
Well, thank you for taking the time, George, and we'll be talking later.
Thank you.
That was George Hodgman. His wonderful memoir is Bettyville, published by Penguin. So here we are again at the end of our time. And I'll be back next week with more writers and more good conversations. So in the meantime, stay in the chair. Get your writing done. If you haven't started yet today, if you can, just take a few minutes. It's all you need. Get some words down. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett on KUCI FM in Irvine.